March 1st, 2012. Or, in the parallel world that we sometimes inhabit, it's February 30th. But in this dimension, it is March 1st. And this is the Hermetic Hour. Now, tonight, we're highlighting our CHS, that's Church of the Hermetic Sciences, Associate Member Program. And it will also be call-in night, so we want to hear from you. And our call-in number is 374-857-1830. I'll repeat that, 374-857-1830. Now, tonight we'll be previewing our forthcoming video, which is now in production, titled The Pathworkings of Magic. Now, this is going to be the first time, as far as I know, that anyone has attempted to actually do a traditional interplane projection over a computer or on DVD home theater. In other words, we're going to do pathworkings that you can sit down in front of your TV set or your computer and actually go on the pathworking. And we've already shot the live temple footage for this, and we will post stills on our website. Now, these pathworking DVDs will go out to our associate members as part of their instructional program. That ought to encourage you to join up. And so, tune in and learn how you can take magical journeys at home. Now, the associate member program, we started out some time back when we started the program, and the associate member program is a program which introduces and carries members on through to the second degree. In other words, the object is to get you all the way through to second degree as far as the work is concerned. Now, I'm going to be honest with you that the second degree, the OTA second degree, I'm sure a number of you have heard about it, and word about it. This is the degree that nobody ever forgets. This is the initiation it's French, and they're very dramatic. And it's not like the Golden Dawn, although, of course, it's the same tradition. But, I mean, it's not like the Golden Dawn. This is the OTA, and this was the original. This was our original initiation. What we used to do back when we got started in 1970, 1971, what we used to do is we give them a long probationary program in which we do everything we now do in first degree. And then we would, if they got through that okay, we would give them this whopper of a second degree initiation, which is, as they say, very dramatic, and it has ordeals, and it really imprints your deep mind with the symbolism and the drama of the Hermetic tradition. So that's something that we really can't give you over a computer or over a TV set or just reading a book or anything like that, that we can't do that. That's something that we have to do. And so what we hope to be able to do in the future, and we all know we're going to do it, is to get people through as much of the program as we can in the associate member program. And then, if you're really good at it and whatever, we're thinking very strongly about being able to bring you, out to Rivendell or Mont Sauvat, or possibly even if we got a big Winnebago, we can haul all this stuff, and you help us pay for it, and we'll initiate you. But that's down the road away, but we're working in that direction, because second degree has to be physical initiation. And first degree is also a physical initiation. It's nice, but it's, you know, it's out in the hinge, and it's not any ordeal involved in it really particularly. So that first degree initiation, yes, you need it eventually, but that can be done. We can do that on a power weekend. We can do both of them if you're really qualified. So you got something to work toward. And yeah, like I said, we're gonna bring that big second degree to you, or you can come out and we'll do it in the facilities that we have. And so the associate member program is set up to move you in that direction if you want to take it. Now, the associate member program, it basically what it amounts to is this. You email me a letter about yourself, and tell us about yourself and what you've been involved in, and, you know, a little bit of, it doesn't have to be deep personal information or anything like that, but give us a little biography of yourself and your magical desires and what you want to get out of magic and all that. And in, you know, as long as you're, you know, okay, and you don't have four eyes and you know, and three legs, we'll go ahead and send you an application through the mail. Now, we do this through the mail because we want to that application to come to your address, and then you can mail also. This bio of yours to the following email. That's hermetics@socal.rr.com. That's hermetics@socal. That's socal.rr.com, all lowercase. And then you that gets over to me, and then I mail you an application. You attach a photograph to it, and we don't want your fingerprint or anything like that, but we do want some background information on there, and you need to sign an agreement with us that you won't go off and run off and steal all this stuff and misuse it and what have you. And then you enclose a check or a money order for $10. And that's U.S. dollars. Now, the Canadian people, they have to enclose a check or a money order, a money order in their case, for $15 U.S. dollars. And it's got to be U.S. dollars, and because postage to Canada is it's getting to be kind of difficult. But and then overseas people, that's $30. Now, the reason why these dues are the way they are is because what you're going to get back when you send this into us, unless you're a terrorist or something like that, then we're going to turn you down. But what you're going to get back for your $10 or $15 or $30 is a package which will contain our video, 90-minute video, The Rites of Magic, which is really, really quite good. And go look at the reviews on it on Amazon, The Rites of Magic. And if you bought it from Amazon, it cost you $25. But and you'd have to pay shipping. We're going to send it out to you, priority mail in the United States. We're going to send it out to you for your $10 dues. And we're also going to send you a certificate suitable for framing. It's nice looking. And an ID card and a password and a booklet and on the associate member program. So you're going to get all that. And most important, or just as important, you're going to get a sheet of coupons. Now, these coupons give you, on a one-time basis, and I'll put your name on all of them, these coupons allow you to buy all of our books and our videos at half price. Now, this, of course, seeing as how our instructional material comes from these books and videos, this is this is a real good bargain, and it gives you quite a little library, because we have the Book of Solomon's Magic, and we have the Golden Dawn Cipher Manuscript, we have the seasonal rites. By the way, I just reprinted our seasonal book of seasonal ceremonies. You're going to definitely need that one. A couple of our associate members are featured in the book. Frater Osiris and Sister Alchemia, and they're right there in the front of the book doing one of our seasonal ceremonies. And that's the whole section on the associate member program in the seasonal book. The seasonal book ordinarily goes for $25, and that, you can get that for half price. And then, of course, we have the Cipher Manuscript at the Golden Dawn, and that's the top of the line on that sort of thing. And if you're really interested in the Golden Dawn, or if that's a great book to have. And but that one's not required. It's not required, but it's a good one to have. The seasonal book you're going to need, and you're going to need the Book of Solomon's Magic. You'll also get the Solomon's Magic video. And that's a classic. And we got the Rites of Magic. Of course, you get that for free. That one. Now, if you already have the Rites of Magic, you can write to me and tell me, hey, send me the Magic of Solomon, and I'll send that instead. And then we've also got that Wild Midnight movie of ours, Beyond Lemuria, which has some very good hermetic information in it, along with being kind of entertaining. And then, of course, we have. And by the way, the Nine Royal Passions of Fred Adams and Svetlana Spiriferia, that comes along for free with your seasonal book, if you order it from us. Doesn't come if you order from Amazon. You got to pay them $25, and you don't get the seasonal rights. But if you buy it from us, it's half price, and you get seasonal rights. And I'm trying to sound like a salesman here, but I really do want to get this material out to you, and I want to show you what the advantages of the associate member program are. So we also have a Dark Mirror of Magic. And that's, Frater Solomon receiving the Sago Millennium Prophecy. And that's a really good video. This program, as I say, has a lot of advantages. Now, as for the instruction itself, the members of the Associate Member Program have already received several lessons this last year. They received the Legenda of the First Degree. Now, this is an extensive document, and when I say legenda, that's a word Albert Pike used to use. It means the summary of a degree. That is, the degree itself is secret, or at least it's private. But the summary is, although it doesn't reveal any of the grips, handshakes, and perhaps a secret word here and there, but it's everything else about the degree. And an extensive analysis that isn't in the degree. So you get that. So that gives you all your symbolism of the first degree, and your philosophy and your symbolism of the first degree that you would ordinarily take out in the Henge at Rivendell or Montsalvat. And then you get that, and then you get an introduction to our yoga program and to our creative visualization program. And these are very detailed documents. And set up on these, especially you can go ahead and start working your creative visualization. The yoga program is an introduction to it, starts you off, but what we're going to do this year, we're going to actually get into giving you all the materials you're going to need to actually do our tantric yoga program. Now, when I say tantric yoga, it's Western tantric yoga. And what I want to do is talk a little bit about this, because you need to understand that the OTA is a blend and a mix of various magical elements that fit together like a glove, and that always should have been together, but we weren't able really to put together a system like this until around about the time we put it together. And the reason for that is that before the 1950s or 1960s, nobody knew what the religion of the ancient Canaanites was. And this, of course, is Solomon's, you know, Solomon's secret religion. And this was the religion behind the Bible. This is the religion that gives the power to the Kabbalah. And if you're adventurous enough to do it, to take it. And nobody knew until those Rosh Hashanah tablets were dug up back in the 1930s. They weren't translated. They weren't available until after World War II. So that aspect wasn't available. Also, even though Julius Evola and Aleister Crowley and especially Franz Barden all tried in their various ways to use Eastern yoga techniques in connection with Western ceremonial magic, they didn't succeed. They wouldn't take, and one of the reasons why they didn't succeed was because they were hamstrung by something that the Theosophical Society had latched onto, which should best be described as a standard version of Laya Yoga, which was published in, I think, 1910 or something like that, by Woodruff, called the Serpent Power. And this, granted, it was a widely used Hindu system, but it wasn't the only one. But it was the one that the Westerners all thought that the entire psychic center system or chakra system had to go along the analog of what Woodruff had put out, and they were absolutely convinced of this, and they couldn't figure out how to get this to jive with the Tree of Life. And so you have people like Crowley and Barden, and well, Barden ignored it, as far as I know. Crowley, he came up with some version of it that was still true, was not really on the Western scheme, and Paul Case tried to make a direct Eastern analog out of it, and that didn't work very well. At least I don't think it did. And so this was in limbo until. After World War II, and we began to realize that, hey, there's all kinds of psychic center chakra systems in the East. My gosh, the Tibetans have got a different one for every deity they practice. And that enabled me and, you know, my people, we looked at this thing, and we had Rigardi's middle pillar already. That was the beginning of it. Rigardi and, well, Falcon, Rigardi developed it from something in one of Falcon's rituals, and he had this inspiration. So we had this middle pillar that did not line up with the Eastern system, and all we had to do was really extend it, and then we realized that Johann Gitchell, Jacob Borum, and Johann Gitchell had developed a thing like this back in the Renaissance. And, oh boy, so we were off and running with a full Western psychic center system, full Western chakra system. We call them roses instead of lotuses, and we call the tankas, we call those icons,
But
essentially, this is a full system, and it works the same way that the middle pillar does. And the Eastern system, by the way, is etheric. Ours is astral, is etheric. So you don't have to worry about well, if it lines up with the glands and all that. Hey, don't worry about that. And we have a precedent with Borm and Gitzel, and even Steiner used this. Or he made a little change, but essentially the same thing. And that is the real bedrock of our power. Now we've had a problem that we're solving with our big website that we have for the Associate Member Program. Now this website is a Ning account website. So you got to open up a little Ning account and you get on it. But the website is beautiful, and it really is. We haven't won an award with it yet, but it's an award-winning website. I mean, it's just beautiful, and Zandre has done a terrific job with it. But we've been having some problems with getting our material on the web, our study material on the website. And I won't go into all the technical problems we've been having, but we're going to solve them. We're going to get them worked out. Because in order to really teach our yoga system, and, you know, any ceremonial magic depends on graphics. And yoga, especially tantric-type yoga, you have to have graphics. You have to. You have to have, mandalas and tankas, you know, if you're going to do the Tibetan thing. You got to have them. And by the way, let me mention something here. In case I didn't mention it before. I spent a year on a weekly and sometimes twice weekly basis studying with Luden Ken Rinpoche in the Sakya order, and that's sitting for 2 or 3 hours in a lotus seat, and we had fortunately a lama who spoke English. And so all of our work was translated into English, both spoken and right. So I know I'm not going to claim that I'm a tantric adept, but I think I can safely say that I know I know the techniques, and I know the mystique and the techniques of Tibetan tantric yoga. I do. So this is what I've done. Is I've taken these techniques and I've applied them to the Western system. And I can tell you right now that this is very, very effective. And this is, but it is, it's involved. And we need to have these roses and these icons. We need to have them. And so we're going to get them and put them up on the website. We've had problems doing that. So we're going to work that out. In about 2 to 3 weeks, we'll have it worked out, and we'll have the first yoga lessons that you can get really into it. They'll be up there. Now, meanwhile, of course, you have the yoga lessons that you have sent out. This, I can't emphasize how important this is, because in the Hermetic tradition, you are the center of the universe. It's your universe. And if you remember, as above, so below, as within, so without. And this means, and Jacob Borm and Johann Gitzel, they knew this. And they knew that man was a replica of the universe, and he was created in God's image. And when you think about that phrase, man was created in God's image, well, that can mean, it can mean, in a lower, very lower, you know, mundane sense, you could say, well, that means God has a nose and a couple of eyes and ears and all that, and two arms and two legs and all that. That it can mean, I suppose it could mean that, And there was one Hindu yogi who said, well, if you say it doesn't mean that, you're insulting God, because God can be anything he wants. Well, that's true, too. However, think of the deeper, deeper meaning of man was created in God's image. What is God? God's the whole universe. He's everywhere in the universe. He created the universe. God is the universe. And so, if you're creating man in God's image, and this isn't just my idea, I mean Jacob Orme, he knew this, and he explained this. If you're creating man in God's image, then man is a miniature of the universe. And what is the universe as far as those who realize this? The universe was the sun, the moon, and the planets. And the stars, of course, were all around, you know, they were part of it too. But they didn't realize at that point that there were all these different galaxies and, you know, endless and whatever. But it wouldn't have mattered because it was the universe they could see. Saturn was the beginning of the physical universe. Saturn. Right up there in the top of the head. That's where Saturn is. And down from Saturn, down from the realm of the fixed stars, comes the creative force that goes right through the chakras all the way down to Malkuth, down there in the bottom, and then, like in the middle pillar, that Rigardi and Falcon, or Rigardi after Falcon, developed, it's the sun is in the chest, into Perith, and Yesod is in the genital region, and he put Malkuth in the feet. But we, being a little more Eastern, we put it right under Yesod, because we do our work either sitting or in an asana. So this is the system, and it works beautifully on the hermetic principle that man is a miniature of the universe. I might also mention, too, while we're on the subject, this is why astrology is so important to hermetic science. Because astrology, regardless of whether it works or not, and it does, believe me, but regardless of whether astrology works or not, as a hermetic magician, you want to learn it, and you want to know it, because it's you're taking charge of your universe. This is your universe, your God. And this is how we say the universe works, and this is how you say the universe works. And if you say the universe works this way, and you're God, it's going to work that way. This is one of the big secrets of hermetic philosophy. One of the big secrets of hermetic magic is that you are the center of the universe. And therefore, if you want astrology to work, this means that you can know more about your universe. You aren't just learning about yourself. You're learning about your whole greater self. And your greater self is the universe. So, hermetic science, alchemy, astrology, and all of these work together. And this is why internalizing all this, you know, with a good yoga, with a good Western yoga program, which comes, you know, through Borm and Gitchell and you know, on down to us and even Steiner and whatever, we have this program. This is different from the Eastern program in many different ways. Number one, their chakras are supposedly connected to glands and whatever, and they're etheric. Ours, on the other hand, are more philosophical. They're in the formative plane, and they're yetziric or astral. Now that right there is enough to deflect any arguments regarding this. And of course, the success of Falcon and Rigardi's middle pillar over the years. Thousands of people have used this successfully, so there's no question that you don't want to listen to anybody telling you, oh, well, you don't want to do that. You want to do it the Hindu way or no way at all. Don't forget about that. Falcon and Rigardi's middle pillar has been used by thousands of adepts for almost 100 years, and it works. So our system is an extension of that, an improvement on that, and yeah, I definitely recommend it. Now, we're going to have that artwork, in other words, the roses and of each, and the C letters and all of this, in our Phoenician alphabet. Now, our Phoenician alphabet that we have, it gives us 24 letters, which we need to have, because that gets us plugged into the whole zodiac. The Hebrew alphabet, the traditional Hebrew alphabet used in magic, only has 22 letters. So, and yet the Greek Kabbalah had 24. So the Greek Kabbalah actually worked better around the zodiac, because you had 12 signs going north than 12 signs going south. If you follow what I'm saying here, in other words, you've got a letter for each sign of the zodiac, and one rank goes to the northern meridians, and the bottom rank goes to the southern meridian. So you can literally, with the Greek Kabbalah, you can, or with our extended Phoenician, which is a direct analog from basic Hebrew Kabbalah, except that we added a zero, which they didn't have per Crater, and we added an omega at the end and double tau, and that gives us a very, very good Hebrew-type version of the Greek Kabbalah, which solves that problem. Now, our alphabet is in Phoenician, and it is in the color scales of the Golden Dawn, making it very, very usable. And also, Phoenician letters are, that's what the Ten Commandments were carved in anyway, if it gives you any problem with that, but shouldn't. But they're much, much easier to cut with a wand, when you're doing your rituals and you're using these formulas. It's much easier to describe these Phoenician letters in color, glowing color, with your wand than it is these complex and sometimes difficult to differentiate Hebrew letters. So, but we have a direct, a direct line of the Hebrew right directly translated into Phoenician. So those of you who are bound and determined you've got to have Hebrew, well, it's right there. You just make the translation, and no problem. Now, the Gitchell book that I would, I brought this thing along tonight because I really want to make sure that anybody is in doubt on this. I want you to get this book and really get into it. It's called Awakening to Divine Wisdom: Christian Initiation into Three Worlds. Now, yeah, it's Christian. All right, I have nothing against that. It's also Hermetic, very much so. It's Johann Greg Gitchell. Well, it's Gregor. It's G-E-O-R-G. I don't know how that would be pronounced in German. Probably Georg or something like that. But it's Johann Georg Gitchell. G-I-T-C-H-E-L. It's edited and translated by Arthur Verse Lewis, and he does a very, very good job. And it's got some wonderful graphics in it. Now, the one thing, though, most of you have seen the Gitchell's Natural Man, which shows our Western Psychic Center system. You've seen that and pictures of it, and we've, of course, published it and all that. But what you haven't seen on the back cover of Johann Gitchell book is a circular version, kind of like a horoscope, a circular version of the circle of the zodiac, and down through the central meridian here, we have the planets laid out in the same arrangement, with Saturn up toward the top, and as we go down toward the center, and then Jupiter, and then Mars, and then the Sun, and then, of course, Venus and Mercury and so on. and the moon. Okay, we have a call. How? You're on the air. Who am I speaking with?
Well, this is Freeman from Alabama.
Yeah, well, welcome aboard. Yeah, now, Freeman,
thank you, brother,
what?
By
what?
Oh, I tell you
yeah,
what.
Yeah, we're glad to have you.
Thank you.
What would you like? What would you like to talk about?
Well, when I first dialed in, you were still busily selling the associate member program, and I was going to help you with that.
Help me, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, I will. Let me tell you, the study materials and these radio shows, and plus the all of the half price material, the DVDs and so on. You know, they're really terrific and really useful. I've gotten, I feel like, a huge acceleration into understanding this stuff. Just from what little I've done, and this is while I'm still having trouble finding time to get real hardcore about the yoga practice and so on. But I've been circling around it for so long. You know, I mean, I've been a pagan magician for over 10 years now, and
mm-hmm.
sort of avoiding the whole big structure of the Hermetic system because it was just too complex. And it had too much Christian stuff in it, and you've heard all the stuff.
Well, like I said, a good Victorian. It has Victorian bric-a-brac.
Yes,
and theosophic
Victorian bric-a-brac. And
lots of theosophy in it too. That I don't have that much against theosophy, but boy, they sure can load on a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and so what happened was at just the right time. Now, I started realizing that, I'm ignoring the elephant in the living room. I'm using pieces of this, and I'm walking around it, and I'm slamming into it. And just at the right time, I started listening to your radio shows. I said, okay, first off, here's a guy who has figured out an intelligent way to repaganize this. So that takes away one objection right there. It's like, yeah, okay, it's not exactly my pantheon, but it's close. So,
well,
okay.
Repaganizing it. This is something I was really. I didn't have much choice because when I got started, I got Baal and Astarte. They were first in the mirror, and oh boy,
yeah.
They haven't turned me loose yet.
Absolutely, you have nothing to apologize for there. You've done a great job of that. I tell you, even before I got into magic, I was into poetry, and I read, I read some Graves, and I read the White Goddess, and I also read the Notes to Eliot's Wasteland. I was looking at this, going, "Wow, a poem with footnotes." But at any rate, he's in there talking about from ritual to romance and all the other Grail stuff, and this was when I was relatively young, and I ended up spending years and years in a sort of literary Grail quest. I had 8 shelf feet of Arthurian books and books about the Grail and this, that, and the other thing. And I had kind of gone off, given up on that, and gone off in other directions. And then I get back to your stuff, and I'm reading the Legend of the First Degree and listening to what you exposed of it on the radio. And I went, oh, okay.
Well, let's for a minute, just for a moment here. Let's go backtrack a little bit. You mentioned From Ritual to Romance by Jessie Wesson.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, this was published in 1920. She was an anthropologist. And essentially what this does is it says that the real Grail legend, the earliest version of the Grail legend that she could research, was the result of a Baal and Astarte ceremony or myth, where Baal gets killed and the river Ebrim in Lebanon runs red. And, of course, that's a natural phenomenon where the water rises up to the hematite layer and it runs red in the spring. And so she extrapolated on that. And then, I read that, and it made a lot, it made sense. But then, when I read the Rosh Imra tablets, their translation of the actual rituals back in 1500 BC, here's Baal with this goblet to awe mortal man and all of this, and I'm realizing that, hey, and Jesse Weston didn't have this when, you know, when she did that.
Yeah, that's the amazing
but
thing.
She was right.
Yeah. Yeah, and I read that book before I was ready for it. I put it aside and thought, no, that can't be exactly right. I got to go off and read all this other stuff first.
Yeah.
and then
oh,
come
yeah,
back
we
and find
would
out that, oh, well, okay, now I'm ready to see it.
Well, with
but
me,
I
was the same you way. I when I ran across that when I was doing it, you know, we didn't have seasonals. Fred Adams and Svetlana, were, you know, they were doing a seasonals back. They started back in 1968, and they were doing a seasonals, and we were going along and helping them. And then my wife Jeanette said, "Pope, we got to have seasonals too. You know, we got too good a thing. You know, this kind of, you know, our Canaanite thing here. We got to have seasonals." So I said, "You know, you're right." So that's when I was taking anthropology at the time, and that's when I got into the library and started you know, researching the seasonals. And yeah, that's when I discovered that. We got another call, do we? Yeah. Who am I speaking with?
Frater Solomon.
Oh, hey there. Hey there, Frater Solomon. Yeah, we were just doing Raphael last night. Add something to this conversation.
Oh, well, you know, I just had to say along that note, these planetary workings that you're giving to the public are great. I've done them all with you, and I can't even let everybody know how exciting they are and how fulfilling they are. It's like you're stepping inside of a movie when you do these things, or stepping onto another planet for a little bit. But not only are you doing that and having your own adventure, but you're leaving with a good moral and good insight to yourself that ends up being very personalized to you. So it's not somebody's preaching at you, but it's the divine is giving you exactly what you need for yourself without any external entity. You really gain a lot from these, and I can't tell everybody just how exciting what you're going to be getting is. I would highly urge everybody who's hearing about these path workings that, you got to get them. They're worth it. They're life-changing.
May I mention that Frater Solomon is one of the three eyes and two horns, and he delivers the wisdom of the original Enochians, you know, in the Book of Enoch. Also, Frater Solomon is the scryer and the prophet in our Dark Mirror of Magic, and that's the Visago Millennium Prophecy. And Frater Solomon continued with the Visago Prophecy, with the Oracle Subsidiel, which is the Simeon Farash angel, which is opposite Visago, and that's in the new seventh ray. By the way, Freeman, did you get a new seventh ray?
I got
Freeman.
I got
still,
the green ray.
You
yeah,
got the green
I'm,
ray.
I'm still here. I got the
yeah.
I got
yeah
the
well,
green
Mike,
ray.
I was going to mention to you that Mike's Oracle Subsidiel are in there, and
oh,
and
okay.
you might want to look at those. Because Mike, you know, some Frater Solomon, he really, when it comes to prophecy, boy, he can really prophesy.
That's that was amazing stuff. And I got the most recent one, and then I also got the two before that. And oh yeah, by the way, the cartoon in, I think it's the Red Ray,
mm-hmm.
with the dark mirror and the guy and
oh
guy
yeah
bang,
everybody
yeah they look terrible, but that is one of the funniest
yeah, yeah,
things
scared of the human,
I've ever seen
great.
In my life. That cracked me up. It still cracks me up just to think about it. That was so brilliant.
Well, describe
how
this
we
to
really
people
think
so
too.
They can see it. There
we
these,
fear all these
two,
things that we don't
these,
need to fear. We just project onto them because they're unknown.
Right.
These two demons, these two really, really gruesome-looking demons, and they're robed up in a circle, in a regular magical circle, and they're staring at the triangle with the mirror, and in the mirror is a guy that looks like a typical businessman. He's, you know, bald, and he's smiling, and he looks like he's about to sell you a used car. And
yeah.
And one the demon that's in front of the mirror with the candles, and he's terrified. He just
sweating.
And then the operator behind him, the other demon, says, "Oh, come on. I know they look terrible, but you can learn things from them." really though, thanks so much, guys, for coming on. I kind of want to.
Yeah, that prophecy series, I'd love people to join in, because some of it's not even, I don't even have the interpretation myself. It's just something that's open, kind of like I'm sure when Nostradamus got his prophecies, he didn't know what all of them meant. So if you haven't gotten that edition of the seventh ray, that's
okay.
Really
we got another
to
one. Yeah, we got another guy coming on, or gal. Who are we speaking with?
Well, hey, Poke, I'm on. I don't know if can you hear me.
Well, yeah.
This is Friday Osiris from Georgia.
Well, hi there. And,
hey, everyone.
Yeah.
Hey, Friday Freeman.
Is this?
Hey,
this is old home week. Yeah. So, what would you like to add to this discussion?
Well, I just wanted to key on to what Freeman was saying about, and what you were saying about that it was only the intelligent historical path to bring back the pagan element to tie everything together. And what you're doing, and just to tie that to what you're bringing into the future with the path workings, is are you aware of the hermetic origins of museums? Just throw that out as a question.
Oh, yeah. Well, the hermetic museum that Arthur Waite collected?
That's the book that A.E. Waite wrote in the Victorian era, but the actual development of museums in the Renaissance was as a hermetic chamber for reflection, where they designed the universe according to hermetic principles and the way that they wanted to see that, and it's essentially a temple in the round, and it reminds me of what you're trying to do with the DVD, that they weren't afraid to use the technology that was becoming available to them at that time, and it's no different than the wavelength that you're putting out with the DVD.
Well, we know that all those original scientists of the Enlightenment were all hermetic magicians. I mean, Newton, for heaven's sake, he was a thoroughgoing alchemist. And even Descartes, the guy that we blame, we keep beating on Descartes all the time, because he separated the imagination from stark reality, and we've been beating on him ever since. But he was searching for the Rosicrucian, couldn't find him.
Mike, yes. Did you also know the name of that famous library in Alexandria was the Museion?
Yeah,
it was the temple
yeah.
of the muses, and that's where we get the word museum in the first place. So it just reflects and reflects and reflects, like the temple in the round, like the art of memory.
Yeah. Now look, that hermetic museum that you're talking about, is this that famous engraving that has the sort of has this big tower on wheels, and it rolls along?
That's the Invisible College, and that was done in 1617.
That's the Invisible College, yeah.
Yep. The title might be the Visible Basilica, but it's Invisible College. That was definitely in Italy is where this began. Also, grottos Jocelyn Godwin, he's got a great book, Pagan Dream of the Renaissance.
I have that one. Yeah.
That it's when they dug down, as they started to get a little bit richer from the trade, and they started digging down the foundations to build taller buildings and uncovering the ruins of Rome. And they found these underground rooms and temples and the way that they were decorated, and they started to imitate that. And they said, well, it needed to be underground, which is where they made the grottos. And, of course, they're really just underground because they were so old that they sank. About a foot every 100 years.
Yeah, Godwin has done some wonderful work, but I think Godwin's masterpiece is the Hypno Errata Mancia of Palatino. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
The
Hypno
Errata Mancia.
Yes, that novel about it.
It's
the rule of four
book, and it's written in the Renaissance by a monk, and this book is a pagan love story that takes place. It's a fantasy. It takes place on another, you know, in a parallel world, supposedly, a symbolic parallel world, and it is a pagan. It is completely pagan, and it's in the form of a novel, and Godwin translated this. And somehow or other, the guy managed to get an imprimatur on this thing. I don't know, but he's got it. It's available. It's magnificent. It's beautifully illustrated. And this was inspiration for that movie, The Ninth Gate. You remember?
Oh yeah.
They Satanized it.
I'll bet we've all seen The Ninth Gate.
Well, let me say this, Pope, too, also your yoga meditation where you go inside the body. Now, you mentioned you've gotten this from the Tibetans where you imagine yourself as 100 feet tall and you go down in your brain and there's the water and all that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's a version of that in the Hypno-Arata-Makya, Polyfly.
I didn't get to that one. What page is it?
Tell me later if you want to.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to check that one out.
You can do stuff like that in the Zen school too. It's not necessarily just the Tibetans, although you know, Zen Buddhism very hard to understand.
Yeah.
So we had to. So we had to do it in a very difficult way. But
well, you know, I gotta give Pat Zaleski some credit for that too. He used that method, and I think I was already doing it, but he used that method for projecting into Enochian pyramids. And what he would do is he'd sit by the, you know, on the double cube, and we'd sit around the double cube, and then we'd make ourselves, we had a little pyramid, we'd create the little pyramid, you know, and put it in the center of the altar. And the pyramid would only be about 3 inches high or something like that. It'd have a sphinx inside it. And what we would do is we'd sit around the altar and make ourselves huge. And so the altar was like a 14-story building, and we're sitting there kind of inert, and then let our spirit bodies go running across the top of the altar and get inside the pyramid and say hello to the sphinx and look up at that Enochian letter on the truncated top of the pyramid from the inside and then project. Boom! And off we went. And John Brooks and I used that same method. I still have the pyramid. To go to the Galactic Council. John Brooks wanted to go to Galactic Council one time. And he said, so we did that. So we built the pyramid. He figured out where on the... you know, you can, with an Enochian tablet, you can actually find a spot in the universe, you know, the physical universe with them. It takes some work, but you can do it. So he found out where, and we went to the Galactic Council. And that's when he talked to the people with the, you know, the silver hair and the purple people with the silver hair. But meanwhile, I was looking across the table at this huge praying mantis, and she said,
"We are the dominant species on your planet." And I just kind of cowered back, and I said, "I have no problem with that." But now, it may sound funny, but it wasn't funny.
Yes, ma'am. Dominant species. Yes, ma'am.
What? No, but seriously, all that making your body huge. I think it's a Tibetan technique, but
it sure does work, and we make good use of it.
There was a technique that we did that was basically going into on every. On every in-breath going into your huge body, and on every out-breath going into your tiny little body down in your
tongue. Hey, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
That is a good
idea. That's an amazing exercise, just flipping back and forth between the world of the very large and the very small.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. This is kind of like super sound, you know. Super sound is when you say it out loud. You're doing a mantra and you say it out loud. And then when you breathe in, you say it inside your head. You can either say the same thing or you can have a refrain. And for some reason or other, now this I get this from Goswami's Laya Yoga, but for some reason or other, it enhances a regular mantra really, really, really enhances it to the point where you don't want to do this when you're driving a car because you put yourself into a trance and go off the road.
Right.
So
yeah, I have enough trouble with that already.
Watch what you're doing.
Yeah. One of the things, though, Mike, Frater Solomon was talking about our channeling thing, something that people need to understand is that in magic, everybody masters these techniques. You should. If you want to advance, everybody masters these techniques. And so operating and receiving and the whole business. So consequently, we teach you, and you will learn how to channel. So why go and pay $2,000 or $2,500 a weekend to have somebody sit up there and channel for you and tell you what's going on
right.
when you can learn to do it yourself? Any comments
Absolutely.
On that?
Yep.
Who have I got with me?
I had a question.
Well, I'm
just
still here.
Again.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I remember always wanting to hear what the channelers had to say when I was first starting to study the New Age movement and didn't realize all I had to do was have a question and get my mind into the right state, and I could have a good, gentle spirit come and answer that question myself just by imagining what that spirit would be like and connecting with that energy.
Yep, and that's true. And the thing that, you know, one thing I want to point out along that line, though, Frederick Hockley, who was actually a predecessor of the Golden Dawn, Frederick Hockley was a great scryer, and he had crystal balls were his thing. He really liked them. And the Golden Dawn didn't that much, but, I mean, he did. And he knew that you had to have safety, you had to have direction, so Hockley was a magician, and he had a wonderful collection of magical manuscripts, and he was a magician, and so he would cast a circle. I didn't use a pentagram at that time, but he would cast a magical circle, and he would invoke with a calling upon the power of God and everything, just, you know, along regular ceremonial magic lines, in order to have control over what he was going to communicate with. And Hockley, that was at that time the spiritualist movement was really going, you know. And Hockley just really, he said that these spiritualists, he said they don't take any precautions at all. They just open themselves wide up. And he says, little wonder how sick they are. They're miserable. They're going crazy. And he said, if you're going to do this, you need to do it in a traditional ritual format. Now, anybody, you guys want to comment on that a little bit?
Well, this is a comment on Frederick Hockley before comments on traditional ritual format. But did you hear about now he also experimented with globes of water in addition to like stone crystals, and he did at one point try to find out, you know, if he added some blood, would that actually what that would do to the potency.
Take it out and bury it under a pile of manure, and you might get a homunculus out of it. I'm not.
Yeah, you know, Indian water is a traditional technique too.
Yeah,
ask any witch.
I'm not into blood magic, and the reason is I know it works, and I know it really does work, and blood releases a lot of energy and all of that, and I really don't think that it's so bad. If you were a farm boy or a farm girl, and you're and if you're whacking the heads off of chickens on a regular basis to make, you know, to make chicken and dumplings or whatever for Sunday dinner, it's no big deal, and that's fine if you want to do that. Unfortunately, urban people, urban kids, should not do this because it has a kind of a, for them, it has a sort of a nasty connotation. And I, so I don't think urban people should do this. And I don't like to do it. I don't like to sacrifice animals at all, primarily because, to be quite frank, I believe that I did that in a past life, and I, mm-hmm. I'm not very happy. I'm still trying to outdo that karma. So I don't like blood magic. Now, however, I do. I will go along with this. If you prick your finger and charge, you know, use it to charge a personal talisman, that might be a different. That's a different matter.
That's just your own blood too. There's not the karma attached to it if it comes from you.
Negative karma.
There's
you know, I like to stay away from this chicken snuffing thing. Rabbits or goats or whatever. I really like to stay away from that.
Right. Yeah, I think he used his own blood, but I was just thinking it would be hard to get into a trance if you got a big cut on your finger or your palm and, you know, he's throbbing.
I was a borderline diabetic for a while and slipped over the border and got myself back out of it. But I got one of these little prickers, you know, these things you prick your fingers with. That's no problem. You can just take one of those and you can get those anywhere and you just pop your finger and put a little drop of blood on the talisman and that's no problem.
Right. Yeah, every time you see that process of, every time you see that in a movie, it's always they're taking a Bowie knife and making a slice across the palm of their left hand with the trick knife that squirts blood. And I'm looking at that going, wow, you know, you're an amateur. You don't need that much blood.
No, of course.
Poke's right. A drop is good.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, but anything, you know, I write screenplays, and, you know, I know that you always got to exaggerate everything. You got to exaggerate everything, especially with anything to do with the occult. You just have to really, really exaggerate because that's what people expect, and they're not into subtlety. You know, there's subtlety is just not where they're at. And also too, we know that magic, that the apparitions or visions of magic are subjective. We know that. And like the other night, Frater Solomon and I were sitting in there doing a Raphael on the Almadel and on the altar, and I was using it was Greg's ball. Oh, it was creepy.
Little resistance.
200 millimeter glass ball, but Greg apparently Solomon's sitting on one side. He's got Raphael. He's no problem. He's got Raphael, and he's channeling fine. So here on I'm out on the other side, and I've got Sarath. Oh, boy. And I've got Sarath in the ball, and I don't want Sarath. He's a solar spirit, of course, but he's the angry solar spirit, and I don't want him. And I'm sitting over there while Mike is having a grand time with Raphael, and I'm sitting over on the ball, straining, gritting my teeth, straining to get Sarath to turn into Raphael. I finally succeeded, but boy, what an effort! Because Sarath is, boy, once Sarath wants to come in, he's going to come in. And so you get, you know, it's subjective. It's subjective. Mike's, and then I get, you know, so Mike's having no problem. He's not having a problem with Sarath. I am. And you know, anybody want to comment on that?
Well, I could tell. A good channeler and a good channeling, both channelers will be in sync. I could tell that energy was there, and I was also commenting, or Raphael was commenting through me, that he had the power to get rid of those spirits. And as a lot of you probably know, Raphael's first story that we know about is he expelled Asmodeus, and we don't picture him usually as being that kind of spirit. We consider him to be this nice, gentle calm angel who just does some nice healings. But these angels, they're really powerful entities. But of course, your mind, when it latches onto something, it still needs to be worked out, and it's not going to be gone in just a second. It took probably a minute. It seemed more like 10 minutes, where there was a fight before Sarath was expelled from that operation. But when he was expelled, we both felt that energy instantly was kicked out when it was kicked out.
Yeah. Did you hear me say Sarath? I think I did say
it
in a low tone voice.
You.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because I wasn't trying to, I wasn't trying to get you upset. I was inadvertent. I was over there sitting on a stool. Now, by the way, for listeners who don't quite know what we're talking about here, we have a double cube, or well, it's a slat altar, but it's the altar top is about 40 inches off the floor, and we have low stools, and we sit down at the altar, and we have the incense burner underneath the top so that the smoke comes up around the crystal. Now, the ball sits on top of the altar, elevated, so we stare up at the ball from either side of the altar, or all four sides of the altar if we're going to do that, and we have candles that reflect inward because they're occluded by horns around the side, so they reflect inward. So this automatically gives us a supernal kind of an atmosphere when you stare up at that ball with a smoke rising around it in a dark temple. So then we chant, and we will invoke, and we'll invoke round robin around the circle, and then we know the angel or the spirit has appeared when we get a feeling of, you get a feeling of that you're on holy ground, and you get this aura around the ball. The ball lights up, and then you get this purple, this electric blue purple aura and gold flecked purple aura around the ball. Then you know you have a presence. Whether you can see it or not, you have a presence. Now, a lot of times you can't see, or some people and some of the others, you don't need to see an angel because they're creatures of light. But you know you got the presence, and the presence will speak through you or whatever. So that's how you do it. But here again, each person's vision is it's shared to some degree, and it's theirs to some degree. And one of the things that is fascinating about this is that we'll pass this around and we'll say, Fred or so-and-so, does the angel speak through you?
Right.
And the man will say, yeah, well, yes, and I'm here, and I'm going to bless you all, and you know, whatever. And then I'll go around, I'll say, sure, or so-and-so, does the angel speak through you? And then she'll say, if she does, if he doesn't, she'll say, not at this time. And then we go around that way. That's the way it works. So,
yeah, it's very nice, yeah. And even if we might be starting on a little bit separate page, when the operation ends, it tends to become a very unified feeling. The nice thing about the angels is they're direct reflections of the good within us, which is also the universal good. So there's a blending that happens throughout the operation where everybody's able to get in sync, usually by the end of an operation. It's very nice.
Well, from a training point of view, reason why, now some people, you know, some magicians may be listening to us and thinking, what are the dickens are these guys doing? Raphael and Gabriel and Uriel and Mikhail, oh my gosh, that's way, way up. That's way, way up there. Why aren't they working with lesser angels? Well, we do work with lesser angels, but the reason why we do Raphael and Mikhail and Gabriel and Uriel is basically, in training especially, is because they are the angels of the hermetic elements. And, you know, hermetic practice is really, really centered on these four elements. And these four elements are the Tetragrammaton, and they are the four archangels. They help you balance these elements. Now, I don't know if you want to mention, these four elements are the four cardinal signs of astrology. Everything in Hermetic science is related to the mastery of and the balance of these four elements, and that's why we emphasize those four archangels. And especially when we're training new people, because they need to get those elements in balance. Now, if I need a reference for this, let's just say Barden's Initiation into Hermetics. The whole book is handling those four elements. So,
Zandri just handed me a note here. Says talk about path workings, because we were going to deal with that. And you know, as I mentioned earlier, I'm in production right now. We've just shot the temple sequences. We're going to do these path workings on a DVD or two DVDs if we have to. And what we're going to do is going to really be unusual. We're going to have the opening and lead in with me sitting in the temple, you know, getting you started in this thing. And then when you go into the Tatwa symbol and you project in, then you're going to close your eyes, and then we're going to have some kind of swirly, some sort of a swirly emotion kind of a thing, or a star field or something like this. We'll pick a good one. And that's going to be going on while your eyes are closed and I'm going to be talking. So you're going to have a chance to sit down in front of your TV set or in front of your computer and actually do the path working. Now, I'm not going to say that it's going to be just as good as if you were in the temple, because, quite frankly, to tell you the truth, when I do path workings, the best path workings, sometimes I've read them, they're not quite as good as if I am in trance with you. If I'm in trance with you, we're right along. We're all going along together. That's the best way. In magic, when you're operating, you should be in almost as deep a trance as the receiver. You really should be.
Right.
You should be right in there with the receiver. You should be. And so I'm going to try, when I do these path workings, I'm going to try to get into a trance over at Mitch's studio. I'm going to try to. So I'll make my best attempt. And if I don't think that those path working scripts, and I know Mitch is going to tell me, Poke, talk louder, talk louder, talk louder. Well, the problem with that is when you're in a trance, as you know, your voice gets down low. Yeah, it does.
Tell people to put on headphones and talk the way you need to.
I'm going to have to.
That's good advice. That really is.
We got to get this thing right. We have to get it right. You know, you guys have all seen the Magic of Solomon video. When we were first editing that thing over in Glendora back in 1996, that scene with my face in the soul door behind the sigil, my ghost-like face back there, reflected face, and then Ball's sigil is in yellow China marker on the front, and then I'm doing this hypnotic conjuration. We're watching this thing, and I was really doing it. I, that's one of the best I ever did, and I'm just going on and make pure and fair and human form without order or deformity and without delay. Come from whatever part of the world thou art and answer my questions. Come presently, come visibly.
And I'm looking at this thing, and I'm realizing we're all kind of going into trance. Our eyes are wide. We're looking at this thing. And I said, no, we can't put this. How can we do this? How can we actually put this on and sell this to people? We're all going to go to jail. And no sooner did we get to reach this point where we're all kind of zonked out on this thing than, bam, all the power in Glendora goes out. The whole town. Now. Oh boy. So
well, so I guess I've knocked out one street light before many times, but you've been all down.
I'm like bell book and candle. Ping. Yeah.
But the path workings that Zandri is reminding me to talk about here, we have the lower section, and this will all be available to the associate members. We have from Malkuth to Yasod, that's 32nd path. We have 29th path from Malkuth to Hod. Air working, of course, has to be way up there on the top of the tree. So we do that sort of as a supernumerary.
But the reason why we do that is because, we need to get all four elements. In the path right, and the air working is the easiest, you know, of the bunch,
and it's the fluffiest, and it's the easiest, and it's nice. So you're going to get all four of these path workings in the associate member program. Of course, you're going to pay us for them, but we'll make you a good deal on it. And then you're going to be able to write us a report on your adventures. One of the important things about our path working system, and it is based on Kirpal Singh's original soul travel system, is the attention points idea. You know, if you're just going to go on an imaginary tour somewhere, you might as well, you know, go to the movies or go to Disneyland or whatever. So the important thing about the path workings is the attention points that you personally experience. And what I mean by that is you come to a particular object or you come to a particular image and you come to a particular inscription, and this is for you. And you interpret this symbolism yourself, and you remember it. And that is directly connected with your personality and finding knowledge about yourself. That's what makes the pathworking system initiatory, and that's what makes it worthwhile. Now, so we'll look forward to that. Geyser, what do you think about pathworking? Of course, in this case, I guess I'm addressing Frater Solomon.
I just think they're great. They're just each of them is one of their own little adventures, and they're all related to a different part of the tree. And they'll spark your imagination, and they'll also direct your imagination, so you actually gain wisdom from it. And the nice thing about combining those two elements, wisdom and imagination, is It makes your imagination more useful, and it also makes your wisdom more engaging. And when you have those images attached to wise thinking, it's easier for you to implement wisdom in your life because you have a solid image to attach to it rather than some ethereal data that you can't really grasp onto when you need it. So it has the nice symbolism attached to it, and it gets your imagination also directed and reined in. Because, as I'm sure everybody knows, the imagination is a wild thing, and it can go in all sorts of directions when you exercise it. But the nice thing about these path workings is it really, first it tames your imagination, but then it also energizes it. It's like coaching to get really good at a sport. You've got to get things under control, but once you do, you can also really excel, and you can do things a lot better than you could before.
Well, thank you for that insight, Mike. Because I want to explain a little bit about this, how this pathworking system developed. Kirpal Singh, who was one of the great Sikh sant masters, and by the way, let me just say this: Sikh sant was the real Eastern system behind Theosophy, not Tibetan Buddhism, as Blavatsky led on. She said that it was Tibetan Buddhism in order to protect Kuthumi and Maurya, who were both Sikh sant gurus. One of them was the Maharaj of Kashmir. And if she had revealed who they really were, they would have had MI5 up there and probably a regiment of Gurkhas and whatever, and they wouldn't have lasted very long. So she moved them to Tibet, and she called it Buddhism, but actually it was more Sikh sant. Now, Sikh sant is a combination of Hindu, Buddhist, and some Islamic influences, and it's about, it was developed around 1500 A.D., I think. And the first guru, of course, was Don Tak. So it is a modern system based on very, very ancient origins, obviously. But Kirpal Singh was one of the great Sikh sant gurus. Now, he developed this soul travel system, this pathworking system, and with the attention points, and with the symbolism that was initiatory. And he developed it. John Brooks, Frater Apollinaris, studied with him in Chicago back in about 1962 or something like that. And John introduced us to it over at 1164, over at the, you know, the big yellow church on Lake Avenue. Anyway, that was about 1971 or two. And John says, I'm going to take you people on a trip to the Temple of Venus. And I said, oh, sure. Come on, let's just do that. And my God, he got, John was a good hypnotist. And boy, it just blew me away. I mean, the symbolism, once I got into it, it was so vivid and it was just marvelous. And I came out of it and I said, John, we got to cannibalize this. We got to make a Western. So we did. And we used Gareth Knight's two-volume set of, you know, cannibalistic symbolism and got this thing cannibalized and used our, you know, some of our Canaanite stuff, but whatever. Got it on the Tree of Life. And it's, it works, you know, it's been, we've been using it ever since. But I want to point something out. Kirpal Singh was the secret master of Paul Twitchell, who started Econ Car, what do you want to call it? Now, you all remember that. Well, Kirpal Singh told him, when you get these people off on the astral, letting them do their own thing, and without guidance, he said, I don't want you to call me your secret master anymore, your master. That's why he couldn't refer to Kirpal Singh, because Kirpal Singh believed that these tours should be guided so that you could actually get something out of them. And like Mike just said, you don't want to go wildly off in different directions. You really don't. Because once you get this deep into the mind, you can teach yourself the wrong stuff. I mean, you can really, you know, the astral plane is a very emotional and you can run into a lot of bad things. Joe Wilson used to take us on journeys into his deep into his head, and some of them were pretty scary. And I don't agree with that. I mean, I like Joe and all that, but boy, anybody want to comment on that?
Yeah, you can just look at the world of imagination. Usually, the imagination that strikes us the most, the art that strikes us the most, is the art that's weird. It goes into a new weird direction that we haven't seen before, and that's why art's always changing. We had the Picasso era where everyone was really excited about something because it was weird and it shocked the mind. And that's how the imagination works. When you're really getting on it, you can just go on these tangents where you're getting weirder and weirder and weirder. And all you're doing is you're just mixing different parts of your brain together. You're taking all of these random ideas that are in different corners and you're slopping them together and they're getting disorganized. And that's what happens when the imagination runs wild, is the brain's just trying to connect the furthest parts that were never really meant to be mixed, at least not if you want something that's elegant and focused. So we can look at our own minds, and I'm sure everybody listening has their own imagination, and it goes in wild directions, and we think crazy thoughts that we feel guilty about, like just all these angry thoughts that we might have of what we want to do to the people that have made us mad, and we just get these flickering thoughts. And if we let our minds just delve into its anger or into our sadness, loathing our depression, we'll just go in all sorts of directions. But if it's guided in someone who's been there and perfected these techniques that haven't just been perfected by that one person, but over several generations, over thousands of years of guidance, we really have something that's a working system that's been perfected that really allows our imagination to become something beautiful. Just like we've seen technology advance, we didn't have cars thousands of years ago, but we did have the wheel. So what we have now with our path workings is we have something that has been perfected over generations and generations and generations. It's an advanced hybrid car that takes a lot less energy to work and works a lot more efficiently than a hand cart that you have to pull yourself that was thousands of years old. So the imagination is something that we really can use with these path workings to get you somewhere where you want to go a lot quicker, you know, whatever goals you have in life, to spiritually center yourself. This is really going to get you on the path to self-actualization, which is the highest of Maslow's hierarchies of needs, and it's really just gonna it's gonna make you happy. It's gonna make you feel rewarded, and it's gonna take all those energies that you have in your mind, and it's going to direct them in a way that you're really gonna feel good about. And all these different areas of the brain, what it's gonna do with them is it's going to ignite them, and it's going to ignite them individually, so they're all working and doing what they're meant to do. So you'll have, for instance, you have the sphere of Bina, where if you want to understand something, you can take a path working related to that, and it'll build that understanding up that you're seeking. If you're just looking to get grounded, then we have Yesod, where you can really just focus on grounding your energy. So all these path workings, they're focused on the diverse corners of your brain, but rather than just trying to slash them all together, it really takes each of those areas of your mind and it builds them up. If you want to focus on the love associated with Venus, you can do that. You want to focus on the creativity associated with Mercury, you can do that. So every one of these path workings, what it's going to do is it's really going to ignite that portion of your mind that usually when the imagination tries to ignite it, it'll just mix a bunch of things together and you won't get an actual focused result. But with these path workings, it ignites your imagination so you actually get a focused result where you can look back in your life and you can say, all right, this path working changed my outlook in this area. And a good thing to do with these path workings, don't just do them, but after you do them, write down what you saw. Have a journal, have a magical journal where you're writing down what you gain, what insights you gain, because when you come back to your normal state of mind, the next day you'll already forget over half of it. So it's really important that when you do these path workings to write it down so when you read it again, it'll continue to reignite that portion of your brain that you opened up, because the path working, it occurs in a different state of mind than your normal waking state. We've got your waking beta state, and then you've got your alpha state. And all these path workings, they occur in the hypnotic alpha state. So it's really important for you to actually record what you're seeing, because you're going to be coming out of that state and you're going to think, wow, that was so powerful. How could I forget that? But you will forget if you don't write it down, because it's not accessible in the beta state like it was in the alpha state.
And if anyone has any good advice on writing legibly when you're in that condition, I'd like to know about it.
Well, what you do is you actually write about it right after you do the path working. You don't do the writing while you're in the path working.
No, I'm just thinking about looking back through my own magical journal at some of the entries that are a year or more old and going, what did I mean by that?
Yeah, I know what you mean. A lot of times the handwriting, it's really quick, and sometimes you won't remember exactly what you're saying. So it's really important to spend some time on that and really don't just jot down quick little notes. Actually put details of what you saw and what you felt. It's really important to just take that little bit of extra time to put a little bit of extra details, because you're right. You can look back at something a year later and you're going to read it, and it's not going to reignite all those things that you had ignited in your mind when you did the path working, because it was a year ago when you were in a different state of mind than your normal waking state. So it's really, really important to put all the details that you remember, and not when you come out of it, you're going to think certain details don't really matter because they're fresh in your mind. You're still just right out of that alpha state, but it's really important to put all those details that you don't think are important. So it's a lot easier a year later to come back and have a really clear understanding of everything you learned. So when you write these things down, don't write it so it would be just useful to you. Write it with it in mind that you're writing it to someone else. Because a year from now, you're going to be a different person. So you bring up a really good point.
Yeah,
it is easy to forget.
I think that is the best piece of advice you can give. That's a wonderful idea.
Well, thank you. Yeah, because you actually brought something up that I've experienced myself, so I'm glad you mentioned it. Learn that through trial and error.
Oh, yeah. Rusty Wizard mentioned, hey, how about dictation? So Dragon Naturally Speaking.
I have
that on my upstairs PC.
Let's see if we're going to wait for Poke to come back. Let me ask you a question. Frater Solomon, when you do your visionary workings, your path workings of any kind, do you ever have a scribe to take take down what someone else is saying in trance? Because that was what Freeman was asking about. Do you ever do that?
We've done that occasionally. It's actually it's a really, really good idea. One of the benefits, though, of not having a scribe when you're doing a past working is you can really, really get into it if you're not relaying what you're seeing to anybody else. If you're just focusing on doing the past working, there's certain times, like when you're channeling an angel or whatever, an entity, that is a good time to use a scribe. But when you're doing the past working, the reason why a scribe is difficult is because you're seeing something. When you're channeling, you're just hearing. So it's a good idea to have a scribe to relay that. We don't do that very often, but that's a really, really good idea. That's been done occasionally, and it's a lot better if you have a scribe who's jotting down notes. But for the path workings, it's actually better, if you can, to just really focus and really pay attention to allow yourself to internalize what you're seeing and think about everything that it means while you're in it, and don't allow yourself to get distracted by having a scribe. You can do that. You can experiment. I would recommend that you don't do that in the beginning of doing the path workings, because it's more important when you do the path workings to really delve into them and get into them and not allow yourself to get distracted by making sure some external entity who's in the waking state is getting what you're getting. Because you really want to, when you go into the world that you're going to be going into the path working, you really want to jump in head first. You want to fully immerse yourself into it. And you don't want to worry about relaying it to the outside world at the time, because if you do, it'll weaken the experience, keep you a little bit too connected to your physical body and less connected to just going on the journey.
Yeah, there's something else that we have an opportunity to practice every day if we're good little magicians and keep up with our dream journals, because it's really a very similar thing. If you you get back into your practice of doing the dream journal and try to write them out in a way that someone else would have some idea of what was going on. That would
dreams are interesting things. Those are good examples of the imagination usually run wild. What I learned to do in my dream journals is I don't know if we're still on air or not. But what I learned to do
sure
with my
still
dream
on the air,
journal
yeah.
is do what I call as a dream edit. I'd write down my dream, and if I thought the ending wasn't good, I would go in, back into dream state, and I would either add on to the ending or go back in time a little bit and erase the bad ending and make sure my dreams always had a good ending that I felt good about.
Yes, I've done that a number of times.
Yeah, it really works, too. When you're first doing these little dream edits, it doesn't seem like they're real, but when you come out of the dream edit, it does feel real, and you do feel better about it. Like, I know some of my dream edits, somebody might have been beating up somebody else, and I'd go back in the dream edit, and I'd break up the fight, and I'd beat up the guy who was beating up the guy who was getting picked on, something like that, just to make sure that whatever monsters I had in my dream never had a power over me or anything that I considered good or innocent. So it kind of it kept my universe in balance. So when I came into waking state, I also had that idea, that calm of just being able to balance out the real universe that we live in. Because the world that we live in, whether we accept it or not, it's really, a lot of it's created by our own imagination. So if we can make our dream state a healthy state where we're feeling really positive and everything's going well, even though dreams, they have a way of going on their own just like the real world does. But if we guide them, we can at least start to get results where, the dream's going on its own journey, but we're making sure we're still guiding the final destination.
Okay, let me ask you this, Father Solomon. So afterwards, after you've written things down in your dream journal, in your magical record, do you ever table out any of the symbols and the numbers and the colors and try to do any kind of analysis on that?
Not so much numerical. Colors, yes. Colors have a lot of meaning. Numbers, I really haven't gotten into numerology just because I've seen people who do, when they get involved in numbers too much, they can drive themselves a little bit crazy. They can think a certain number is bad luck or a certain number is good luck. And unfortunately, the universe just doesn't tend to follow rules of numbers always meaning one particular thing. I can look back at my life, every Friday the 13th I've ever had, it's never been a bad luck day. It's always been a pretty just good, normal day. So whenever I have a Friday the 13th, I kind of look forward to it and thinking, I'm not going to say I'm going to win the lotto today, but things will be normal today.
But you're not in the Knights Templar in this incarnation.
That's right.
Wait,
yeah. Good luck.
What about the Knights Templar?
I said you're not in the Knights Templar in this incarnation. It was a bad luck day for them.
Oh, that's true.
So it becomes a holiday after that. Robert Solomon, good book. If you ever wanted to look at some more interesting sides of looking at the numbers in the symbolism, is something called the Canon. The Canon by Sterling. Let's see if I find Sterling.
Okay. Now, that might be good. There's a number that I keep getting in my life. I have a ridiculously highly improbable likelihood of always getting the number
what?
43.
Mike?
Yeah.
Michael, I've been off the air for a while.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, I think we've been off the air for a while. But go ahead and kind of recap a little bit of what you're talking about, and we had to call back in. So what were you discussing in the last 3 minutes that we were trying to get back?
It was really neat. We talked about dream journals, and one technique that I've come up with my dream journal is if I didn't like the ending of a dream, I'd go back into the dream state and I'd fix the ending. And I kind of related the correlation between imagination and the real world. We can't always control the journey in our lives or in our dreams, but we can control the destination and make sure we're going to a good destination. So I did those dream edits, make sure the dream has a happy ending.
Yeah.
And it's just changed my outlook in life. And what's your name, who I'm talking to?
This is Frato Osiris here. This is another mic.
Oh, Frato Osiris. You brought up a really good point, which is analyze the colors that you see, because colors have meaning. Colors have moods. Colors say a lot about you. Frato Osiris was talking a lot about numbers, which is something I'm not too familiar with. I've always been a little bit hesitant to get into what numbers mean. But it sounds like you know a lot more about that, and that is something that certainly can be looked to when we think about the symbolism behind numbers. Because you're right, numbers certainly have symbolism, and they occur in nature. So I think that's the gist of what we were talking about, and Frato Osiris certainly, I'm sure, can add to that too.
Well, yeah, it's another language that we can learn. That just gives another doorway for things to speak to you through. There's the good book that is kind of the heavy duty on there is called The Canon. Trying to look up the title exact for you, but it's something like an exposition of the ancient pagan mystery as transmitted through the Kabbalah or something like that. Let me find the title.
We got, while you're looking, we got another call coming in. Who we got on the line now?
This is Andrea Wittner.
Ah, Andrea Wittner, Maestro, welcome aboard.
Hello,
yeah, we've been talking about lucid dreaming and dream records and
I know, I was thinking, well, I might have to become an associate. This sounds cool.
Oh, yeah. It's fun. It's fun and it's life-changing. It's positive stuff.
You can't talk about killing chickens unless you're a voodoo priest. That's the new rule.
There we go.
I was off for about 3 minutes. I got disconnected, so you guys were carrying on. We're wrapping up lucid dreaming. Everybody should keep a dream record. And of course, when you start cuts, one thing I want to point out on that. OPL, Ed Peach. I think we all gotten some of Ed Peach's little books at one time or another. OPL had, I think, the best method. If you're not a natural pop-outer, if you're not a natural OOBE kind of guy, this dream method for astral projection, for learning astral projection, is really good. And you can work that along with your lucid dreaming. And, of course, keep a dream record. Yeah,
absolutely. I love, and I had some wonderful experiences while I was actually very religiously keeping a dream record. But I'll tell you what I was also doing at the same time. I was also meditating many hours a day, keeping regular hours, and popping about six grams of melatonin every night so that I actually stayed asleep.
Yeah. Well, you know,
yeah, some people need it
every night too.
Yeah. I had a question about Ophiel's astral projection book, actually. There were in the Body of Light method. He talks about building the body of light from etheric substance. And when you were doing your show, Prophet Fabian, you talked about building a body of light on the astral, which I think I can see how that makes sense. But can you say something about the advantages of either way, or why Ophiel would have said one and you said the other?
That's a very good question. Ophiel Ed Peach was really good, and you know, we've all learned a lot from him. He was doing regular Western traditional training back when hardly anybody else, you know, right in the early late 60s and the early very early 70s. But Ophiel did tend to simplify, and he tended not to get too much into hair-splitting philosophy. He was just, his approach was really, okay, now we're all just going to get and do this, and we're going to make it practical, and we're not going to fool around with all this philosophical stuff. He's good, though. I mean, he really was, and so I'm not knocking Ed Peach, but here's what my little experience with this. I always did, you know, I used Ed Peach's dream method, and I had some dream projections that were incredibly vivid and scared the dickens out of me one time. I didn't know whether I wasn't quite sure I was projecting. I thought maybe I was just dreaming, or I thought maybe I was really awake. In fact, yes. It was so realistic that I thought I was awake. And then I got this creepy feeling like maybe I'm not. Maybe I am astroproject. I don't know. What am I? And I'm walking around the house, and what I did was I stuck my fingers through a glass window. And this was the weirdest and scariest thing. Because the glass, scratchy glass, going around my hand, and I'm sticking my hand through it. And I thought, oh my gosh, if I pull my hand back, I'm going to rip my hand off. And it was that tactile. And then I realized I was projecting.
That reminds me of my first experience too.
Right.
Yeah. I was walking in my room, and I thought I was just awake, and the lights were off, and then all of a sudden I had some papers left out, and my foot was stuck in all these fibers of this papers, and then I realized, oh my goodness, I'm not in my body right now. And that was. I think that might have been one of my first astral projection experiences. It's something I'd been trying for 15 years, couldn't do it. And the funny thing is, when I first did it, I didn't even realize I was out of my body.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. This is a marvelous sensation. Everybody should do this. Everybody should. However, I asked. Because we were doing POWA practice, and after Vajrayogini, we started doing POWA. And POWA is Tibetan death practice. Okay, this is when you start dissolving your body below the waist, you start dissolving yourself, or if you want to feed yourself to the hungry ghosts, you can do that too. But you start dissolving yourself, and then you get all the way up, and then you just go out once you completely disintegrated your body. That's POWA, and that's death practice. And it's what a theosophist, an old-fashioned theosophist, or even Barden would call a mental projection. You're doing this with your imagination, and you're actually doing this. It doesn't feel like a pop out, but by the time you get up to the top, it's very effective. But it doesn't give you that pop out, stare back at your body sensations, you know. And I asked Leading Ken the Abbot, and I asked him. Of course, I had to do it through a translator, through Samten. I said, well, what you know, I've been trying for years and years and years to get one of these directed controlled pop-outs. And all I can do is I can do it with the Dream Method, and then I have to do it, and otherwise I have to do it a mental projection. So I said, this is so important that I want to be able to do it. How do we do this? And he looked at me with a kind of a fearful expression on his face. And he said, what do you want to do that for? He says, you do that, he says, you don't want to loosen your whole body from your body. No, he said, do it with your mind. And at that point, I realized that at least the Tibetans, they're not into this OOBE thing. They're into basically like what we call an interplane projection. So yeah, you should. Yeah, I kind of did it with the Dream Method, but then the remote viewers, they proved. Yeah, the remote viewers proved that you could send your mind out. You could send your consciousness out, but your body stays there. And so I don't really think that it's necessary, especially after, you know, what Lute and Ken told me, I don't think it's necessary in order to do our work. I don't think it's necessary to effect one of these real snap pop things where you've got to, you know, dragging a silver cord along, and I think you can do it with what we call an interplane projection or a mental projection. Now, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But that's what I think. Let me just talk about that.
Yeah, I've noticed with these path workings, I've had my out-of-the-body experiences, and it doesn't feel the same on a path working. You do feel like it if you needed to. You could come back to the physical plane. When I've done the out-of-body experiences, you're so out of your body, there's a sense that you kind of wonder, where is my body? But the nice thing about the path working is you can still feel about a tenth of your soul. It is still connected to your physical body, so if you needed to go back to it, you could. But the nice thing is after path working, it seems just as real as if you were actually there. So you might be, when you're first doing these path workings, you might think, well, I'm still kind of in my physical body, aren't I? But after you do the path working, you'll look back and you'll say, I really felt like I was there. And then as you start doing these things more regularly, these path workings, you'll get used to the fact that you haven't lost your body. Whereas in the out-of-body experiences, you'll often get the experience, Where did my body go? I feel like I have a body, but I notice that it's more of a spiritual body. It's not my real body. And, hey, how do I get back into my body? And often that fear will bring you right back into your body. But when you're doing the path working, you'll have a comfort of knowing you're still connected to your body. There's not the fear of I'm a little bit lost and bewildered that you might have with an out-of-body experience.
You pop out of your body.
On one of my very first journeys, I met a guide who explicitly told me, in these terms. He said, "Remember, you can always just go straight up." And the way I was seeing things was that it was an underworld trip, so straight up would have been. It was what he was trying to tell me was, don't be afraid of whatever happens on this side. Because if you really need to, you can let go of this and pop right back into your body, just like you were saying.
That's really good advice. Yeah, that's a good guide.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole... So in magic, I think the point we want to make here is that we are not trying to train you in our operations. We're not trying to train you to pop out. That's not what we're trying to train you to do. Now I know some people pop out in path workings. I remember my ex-wife used to float around the ceiling while the rest of us were still doing the induction. Yeah. So, but some people can. So if you want to pop out, pop out. But that's not what we're training you to do. And we're training you to do what we call a mental projection. And an interplane. It can be very realistic. It can be very effective. But it is essentially like what the remote viewers are doing. This is what we're training you to do. However, I encourage I personally encourage everybody to experience the pump out, you know, idea. And the best way to do it, I found, was use Ed Peach's dream method. Yeah, you want to experience it, and you should. I mean, it's experience, but don't try to do it in the temple unless, you know, you do it naturally. Well, you can go ahead and do it, but that's not what we're trying to do. We only got a few minutes left, and I want to mention a couple of things. Number one, Frater Hercules has our programs, our Hermetic Hour programs on YouTube, and he has filmed some very, very beautiful introductions to them, and you ought to go check YouTube, and it's youtube.com/ The Hermetic Hour, all one word. That's YouTube. Perfect. Yeah, youtube.com/ The Hermetic Hour, all one word. That's it. Go there, and Frater Hercules has done a terrific job with these dramatic montages from some of our videos and all, and he's just really, really great. So really, really, really needs to be looked at. Now, Sorors Andrea has the YouTube. She has established the youtube.com/ The Magic Channel. And that's something you really... Oh, yeah, you need to look at that one. And that has our material on it, and also it's got a lot of, you know, stuff that relates to us, and it's really, really top-notch. So, check those out.
Speaking of which, I call for a virtual toast to Sorors Andrea right now.
What?
But it's just amazing, everything she's doing.
That's
and,
very
you know,
true.
She just stays in the background, and we don't hear too much from her. Wonderful person.
Well,
she really
is. She's our right hand here. We can't do any of this without her. Yeah. Yeah. So,
but besides,
she's done
more for the order, from my experience in the order, than anybody. It really is just as far as really working hard to get us known and to bring our work to people all across the country, not just here in Southern California. You're really right, and I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, she just puts a lot of tireless effort, and you're right. A toast to you, Sorors Andrea, for all you do for us. We really do appreciate it.
Yeah, well, she's running the chat room, of course. You know that along with this, and she can't hear us, but she can hear the people in the chat room. So they're probably telling her that what you're saying. so that's great. She appreciates it, and of course we appreciate her. Now I'm going to be along that line. I'm going to be involved in this very intensely involved in this pathworking script. I'm going to be off live for 2 weeks, and what we're going to do is Sorors Andrea during that time is going to rerun the pathworking Hermetic Hour and the Yoga Hermetic Hour. So when I come back on after I get this thing done and get it wrapped up and ready to go, then we'll come back on with a big show on the new pathworking, and by that time we'll have the yoga, the first lessons with the graphics and everything on that website, the Ning website, our Hermetic, our Church of Hermetic Sciences website, the Ning one. We'll have that up, so you'll be able to get into the yoga program. So I'll see you guys in about 2 weeks. And I will, but I mean you'll be picking up on our review during next Thursday and the following, and we'll see you then. And thanks so much for calling in. And meanwhile, have
a
good one. And
thanks.
What?
Yeah, great contributions tonight from everybody. Thanks.
Oh yeah.
This has been really great.
Thanks, Osiris and Andre and Freeman and all of you, and Mike, thanks so much for calling in, and that was a great show, and we will see you in 2 weeks, and boy, by that time, we'll have the pathworking in pretty good shape. We can even maybe play you a little bit or something.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Okay.
Wow.
Take care.
Bye.
Good magic.
Thank you. Good magic.
Good magic.